Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. I've always had this particular fantasy where I meet a super smart entrepreneur and I invest early in her company. And a couple of years later, boom, at IPO, since I was investor number three, I walk away with $1 zillion. Okay, well, so that's a simplistic fantasy along the same lines as my fantasy of using my family's birth dates to win the lottery. But you get my point. Venture capital is a rarefied business with enormous risks and potentially enormous rewards, but neither of them are usually accessible to your average person. But now, you don't have to be a wealthy VC to get in on the game. This week, the Securities and Exchange Commission activated new rules that make it possible for people making less than $200,000 a year to $200,000 a year, they would be able to invest in startups. It essentially democratizes venture capital. But is that a good thing? Well, for more on what that means for potential investors and startups, we're joined by Peter Cohen, business lecturer at Babson College and author of Hungry Startup Strategy. He's also an angel investor. Peter Cohen, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Meghna.
Also with us today from San Francisco is Mike Norman. He's co-founder and president of WeFunder, one of the websites that's now hosting equity crowdfunding campaigns, and he also helped create the new SEC rules. Mike Norman, welcome to you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Hi. So, Mike, can I just start with you since you're on the new crowdfunding side of things? Can you just tell us briefly, describe how it works? If I'm an average person now, how is it that I can invest in a startup?
Yeah. So basically, you can come to one of these funding portals like ours, put in some basic account information about yourself, your social security number, you know, your income and asset level, and then browse the site, find a company that you like. You can enter an amount of money that you would like to invest in that company, quickly sign some documents online, and then once the campaign closes, you will be an investor in that business.
And forgive me if this sounds like a bit of a gauche question, but how does this differ from Kickstarter?
It's a great question. So Kickstarter is a perk crowdfunding site, which means that generally your only options are to either buy a product in advance before it's actually been created or donate to some type of project. So you can't actually invest, meaning buy equity or buy some type of debt.
I see. So in this case, you get that equity. In the case of a company like yours, like WeFunder, you get equity instead of a little product. I gotcha.
That's correct.
Okay, so Peter Cohen, let me turn to you. What's the problem with this?
Well, the only problem with it is that if you are an investor and you want to make a return on your investment, you have a roughly 99% chance of losing all your money. So you might as well just take the $2,000, get $120 bills, open your roof of your car and drive all along Mass Pike and let all the money go away.
Not to put too fine a point on it,
sorry,
Peter Cohen.
Yeah.
So basically what you're saying is that the risk for the average person far outweighs the potential reward. But then, I mean, venture capitalists do it all the time with vast sums of money. So what's the difference?
Well, the difference is that venture capitalists lose a lot of money too. I mean, but on balance, the average venture capital portfolio, about 1 out of 10 companies does really well. 2 sort of break even, and the other 7 basically get wiped out. But they make so much money on the one company that it more than offsets the losses from all the other ones. So what would happen under this crowdfunding rule is that the venture capitalists, who even have pretty tough odds of making money, would find themselves getting the most attractive investment opportunities, and the only ones that they, you know, the ones that they would turn down would ultimately trickle into these portals. And so the odds of an investor actually getting their money out either through a sale of the company to another company or an initial public offering would be even lower than they are for a venture-backed company, which, by the way, are not very good these days, especially because there hasn't been any IPO market all year.
Well, listeners, so you've heard sort of some pros and cons from two very very knowledgeable people in the world of startups. What do you make of this idea of that the average person could very easily invest in a startup now, a realm that was once only belonged to venture capitalists? Would you do it? Would you become a investor in a startup? Would you put that $2,000 in for the risk that you'd hit upon maybe the next Facebook? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. Mike Norman in San Francisco, let me turn back to you, because Peter Cohen makes a couple good points. The first of which I wondered about this too is that, you know, for the companies out there who are seeking seed money or startup money, and they don't get it from venture capitalists, and they go to a site like yours instead. I mean, doesn't that already tell you something, that maybe they are an even higher risk if VCs have given them a pass?
Well, first, I'd like to say I do agree with Peter that these are risky investments. Startups are very risky. People should not be investing, you know, money that would be in their retirement account or, you know, potentially in their kids' education fund. That being said, I think that Peter's actually very wrong about the fact that good companies won't use this. We actually have a company on the site right now, Beta Bionics, who received a large investment from Eli Lilly, a VC firm, one of the larger pharmaceutical, you know, companies we have in the world. We'll have a couple Y Combinator companies, which is, you know, the most exclusive startup accelerator in the world as well. So good companies will want to use this, and they want to use it for a few reasons. One, you know, entrepreneurs really want to be able to have their customers and their users and their community members as investors. One, because it's the people that believe most in the business, and two, because it really turns them into a really powerful marketing force to be able to get out there, tell the word about the business, recruit more customers, so on and so forth. So I think there are instances in which many, you know, companies that can go the route of VC will choose not to go the route of doing crowdfunding. Mm. And so maybe in general, the pool that you're going to see for investments that are going to be available to retail investors will be of lower quality than if you're, say, a top-tier VC.
Yeah.
But there will absolutely be very good, high-quality companies that will take advantage of the exemption, as we've already seen only on day two.
Peter Cohen, let me turn back to you, because, I'm still, my mind is still dwelling on this risk-reward question. But
yes,
Don't these new SEC rules mitigate that a little for we average investors, because they require the companies to present GAAP financials? I mean, basically, they have to do their own accounting and disclosure. That can actually cost a company tens of thousands of dollars, which is not a requirement, if I understand correctly, when a company seeks accredited venture capital. So doesn't the requirement to present accounting financials to smaller investors perhaps mitigate the risk?
Well, first of all, from what I understand about the rules, and I'm really not an expert on them, depending on the amount of money you're raising determines whether you have to provide audited financial statements or not. So I think if you if you're trying to raise more than a certain amount, you do have to provide audited financial statements. Below a certain amount, you don't. But I've invested in seven private companies, and I've gotten some excellent information from them about their performance and their prospects. But even with all that information that you might get, if you get audited financial statements about a company's past performance, in all likelihood, they will be losing money. And so you're basically getting audited financial statements to tell you they're losing money, and you have no way of knowing what the future of the company is going to be. Now, they'll make projections about how great it's going to be, and the companies that are in the crowdfunding sites might be, you know, trying to do great things. But it's one thing to try to do great things, and it's another thing to grow a company to the scale where it has enough revenues and profits to be able to go public or to be sold. And so I guess what I'm saying in a long-winded way is that, yes, you might get audited financial statements, but they won't really help you, even if you do, if they're raising enough money to require to get those audited financial statements. It won't necessarily give you information that will help you to determine whether this is a good investment or not.
Right. I'm going to jump in there because I want to turn back to Mike Norman. Mike, what Peter said, we have heard on this show multiple times from angel and venture capitalists, that really when they have, because they have the opportunity to sit down intimately with the people who are seeking capital, and they get to know the person, they get to know the business model, the idea, but most importantly, again, they get to know the person. And we've had, you know, billion-dollar VCs tell us really what we're doing is investing in that person and then providing, you know, advice, et cetera, everything we can do to help the company reach some form of success. That relationship that comes through accredited venture capital, if it's not there, the average investor doesn't have that advantage. I mean, isn't that Isn't that a concern?
I think it's true that you don't have as much information about a company as when you can sit down, you know, and talk to the founder and kind of hear, you know, their vision for the future. We try to do as good a job as possible as putting that up on a website. So through the videos, you know, obviously the textual narrative, and then all the other assets that we put on the profile, we try to communicate as much as possible about the way the founder thinks about the future, what their plans are for the business, so on and so forth. I do want to like make one, I think, very important point, which is that we're focusing a lot on returns as the motivation for investors that are coming into, you know, this new offering type. But we have a huge range of businesses on WeFunder for which many of them, the goal is not to make a huge cash, you know, profit through an IPO or an acquisition, right? You can think about if you wanted to have a very specific, you know, whole food, locally owned store in your neighborhood, which is selling the goods that you want, you might invest in that business, never expecting for it to go to an IPO, but that is a product that you want to exist where you live. You want to be able to help the founders actually get it up and off the ground.
Yeah.
Maybe you know who the founders are personally. And so a lot of the motivations for people investing in these offerings are going to be about investing in the product and the business because they want it to exist. And if the profit comes, then that's great. But that's not the primary motivation.
So, Peter Cohen, let me just dovetail on what Mike said, because I wonder, I mean, this could be a potential huge boon for all sorts of small companies and startups who aren't in Boston. They're not in Silicon Valley. It could give them access to capital that they otherwise wouldn't have. And if, as Mike is saying, for a lot of investors, you know, hitting it big off the investment isn't necessarily the primary motivation, you know, what's wrong with that?
It's nothing wrong with it. You know, I think it is good for the companies that would otherwise not be able to get capital, as long as the investors realize that they're basically throwing their money away. They're not going to get their money back. They're not going to get a return on their investment. I think it should be very clear if they put their money into this, that they are very unlikely to get their money back. And if they know that up front and it's disclosed clearly, then I think that's their decision to make. I mean, it's a free country, and if they want to spend their money on that, they can, or maybe they can put their money into a charity where it's more obvious that the money is not going to be coming back to them.
Well, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us. We're talking about new SEC rules that allow investors making less than $200,000 to invest in startups for an equity stake, small as it might be. This is a major change from how capital has been raised for startups in America from before. So we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Join us with your thoughts on whether or not you would invest in a startup through these new mechanisms. We're joined by Mike Norman. He's in San Francisco, and he's co-founder and president of WeFunder, one of the websites now hosting equity crowdfunding campaigns. And we're also joined by Peter Cohen. He teaches business strategy and entrepreneurship at Babson College. He's an angel investor himself and author of a number of books, including Hungry Startup Strategy. So let's get some callers in here. Paul is calling from Saugus. You're on the air, Paul.
Yeah, investing in a startup sort of reminds me of...
Paul, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Apparently, your cell phone line from on the road is terrible. I'm sorry about that, but I see that you wanted to say that people need to educate themselves about investment first before they dive into the world of startups. Try and call us back again. See if we can get a better line for you. Let's move to Alex, who's calling from Medford. You're on the air, Alex.
I'd like to say that I think the market is being driven right now by the consumer, and allowing the consumer to invest in a smaller startup makes a lot more sense because people are paying, you know, a local organic shop a lot more money for the same product because they're responsibly sourced and they're using, you know, new technology that is, you know, not based on fossil fuels. So I think allowing the market to continue to drive smaller startups into the future where, you know, the focus can really be chose on a local level what people do approve of and don't approve of for business practices.
Mm. Well, Alex, thank you so much for your call. Peter Cohen, this sort of echoes what we were talking about earlier, but I wonder if you have a response to him.
Yeah, I mean, definitely, as long as he would be willing to, you know, invest that money in a way that would not come back to him financially, and he gets psychic satisfaction from putting money into that without getting any of the money back, I think that's fine. I mean, it's a free country.
Let's take another call. Sam is calling from Cambridge. You're on the air, Sam.
Hi, thanks. I'm just wondering, it seems to me that VCs, when they make investments in companies, they have access to a lot of proprietary information that companies don't reveal publicly for competitive reasons. Presumably, companies aren't posting all of this information on the website for these smaller investors. So I'm just wondering, how is it supposed to be possible for investors to make a fair valuation without the kind of information that you normally only share proprietarily with investors? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Sam, thank you so much for your call. Mike Norman, I think that one's for you.
Yeah, so this goes to some of the kind of protections that you were talking about earlier. You know, now that we have a offering type which is actually regulated by the SEC, companies are required to file their risk disclosures, to file any material information about the company publicly. So if you're going to take advantage of the offering, you actually do have to disclose that information. Now, that being said, there are always going to be, you know, kind of trade secrets or strategy plans, so on and so forth, that aren't necessarily going to be revealed. And investors won't necessarily have access to that information. But I do want to give kind of a quick example here. You know, one of these unicorn companies, as they're referred to in the Valley, that has Peter claims is would never use crowdfunding. We had Zenefits, which is one of the largest, fastest growing companies of the past couple of years, on our platform at a $9 million valuation. The last round of funding that they raised put them at a $4.5 billion valuation. Only a few years after the fact. So,
but Mike, let me just jump in here because I'm not sure, quite sure you fully answered the caller's question, because basically he was saying if a small investor doesn't have access to the kind of proprietary information that a VC would have, mm-hmm. you're still making an investment, $2,000 or not, whatever the value is, with incomplete information. So how can you be fully confident in that?
Yeah, no, I think that he brings up a great point, right? You're going to have access, as is mandated by the SEC, to the broad majority of information about the company, but there will always be specific things that you're going to pick up in a conversation with the founder and the time that you would spend with them as a venture capitalist before making an investment that you won't have access to. And so, you know, as the other caller said, education is going to be very important. We do a very good job, or we like to think we do, of educating investors about the risks on WeFunder. And you just have to be cognizant of that.
Well, Peter Cohen, I'm curious about something. Yeah. Part of me wonders if, you know, folks like you who've been in the angel and venture world for a long time automatically say that this is a terrible idea because of, you know, a word that I used at the very top of the segment, that this essentially, these new rules democratize the world of venture capital. And I'm thinking, you know, we're seeing a lot of that in the economy these days, you know, taxi drivers and Uber, that kind of thing. Anytime you open the door to other players, other stakeholders in what was previously a very cloistered world, there's going to be some pushback. Is that part of, honestly, is that part of the discomfort that you have with these new SEC rules?
Not really, because I started off my investing, you know, career as one of these people who would be not a qualified investor. Basically, I didn't have any experience investing, and I've seen over the last 20 years of investing in startups how risky it is. And I'm just afraid that this is a little bit like people who watch TV shows like, I don't know, Shark Tank, and they think, wow, it's cool. Here's Barbara Corcoran, and here's Mark Cuban, and they're, you know, buying $200,000 stakes in these startups, and I want to be cool like that. But they're not. They don't really have the education to realize that it's very difficult to pick the winners. I wrote a book about this topic to sort of codify my approach to investing in startups, and I've been pretty lucky, and I don't know whether I would continue to be lucky in investing in them, but I've kind of accumulated some ideas about how to pick companies to invest in. And it requires a lot of discipline. I've developed a Hungry Startup Strategy Index that involves 26 factors that I evaluate to decide whether to invest. I'm guessing that the average investor would not know that, would not know how to do that analysis, and not know how to figure out how to separate the 4.999 million companies that are unfunded that don't become big and
right.
one that does.
But on the other hand, they have the opportunity to maybe start that learning now, which they might not have had before these new SEC rule changes. Peter Cohen, he teaches business strategy and entrepreneurship at Babson College, author of a number of books, including The Hungry Startup Strategy. It's always great to have you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Mike Norman, co-founder and president of WeFunder, one of the websites now hosting equity crowdfunding campaigns. He helped craft the crowdfunding portion of these new SEC rules. He joined us from San Francisco today. Mike, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.